So, Sister of the Bride.
Okay. We're recording right now, right? We're just going into this.
Yeah, we're just totally recording.
Okay.
This is the part of the recording where we're just getting used to talking to each other again after a month.
Okay. Yeah. Well, do you want to do like a little intro thing?
You've been listening to the opening lines from The Strange and Lonesome Death of Tootie Bodger by Beverly Cleary.
I guess this is just one of those days, thought Barbara McLean on her way home from school one bright afternoon late in April. She was not alone. She was walking beside a boy, a very tall boy, but their thoughts were like those famous parallel lines that lie in the same place but never meet. Barbara was mulling over the events of the day. First, there was that argument with her brother because his cat had clawed one of the stuffed animals she kept on her bed. At breakfast, her father had lectured her on doing better work in chemistry. Part of the afternoon had been spent in conference with her counselor, who thought she should have her future planned as neatly as an English composition. He was an English teacher who thought life should have a topic sentence. And now she was being walked home by Tootie Bodger.
I don't like Tootie Bodger.
Oh, no.
I
No.
just
He's terrible.
I just could not stand him as a character, and he only has like seven lines in the whole book, but he gets mentioned like 123 times. I did a word count at some point. I was like, how many times do they say Tootie in this book? And it's far more times than you would think that they would actually say. It's over 100 times Tootie's
Right.
name gets mentioned.
Yeah, I like the fact that at the end of the book, it's set up that Barbara is choosing between Tootie and Bill, and neither is particularly great, but Bill is sort of like, oh yeah, I can see going out and going bowling with him, but Tootie, I just don't understand why anyone has the time of day for him.
No, he's a loathsome character, and he's unlikable. Nothing he does is interesting. All he does is complain. And I did spend like the bulk of the book terrified that she was going to end up with him. Like there was going to be this sort of like half-hearted like, but then she saw like that Tootie really was a nice guy. But then I guess I sold was selling Beverly Cleary short, 'cause I knew she would do something a little more interesting than that by the end. But yeah, so I wish worse had come to him, but like I really
Like, what
didn't like.
worse did you want to?
I don't know. I wanted him to end up sad somehow, like just or like walking away,
Falling into an open manhole.
like he gets drafted or something. I don't know. Like it's like, oh, she finally calls Tootie to like ask him out, and his mom's like, "Oh, you didn't hear? Like Tootie got, he's been sent overseas." Like I don't know. I found him a terrible character
Well,
from top to bottom.
this book was published in 63, so I guess Vietnam would just be starting.
Maybe he signed, maybe like she's like, I don't want to go to the movies with you, and then the next day he enlists.
Yeah.
I don't know. But so this is a Sister of the Bride by Beverly Cleary. It's
Yes.
the final first of the First Love series.
Yeah, and again, a kind of a misnomer, I feel. I think that
Yes.
these books do deal with romance, but they deal with romance to set up your expectations and then kind of confound them.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Definitely. And this book, I thought, did a much more. I was really curious starting off as to where it was going to go. And then it suddenly introduced like layers and layers that I wasn't expecting.
One of the things that I have had a slight problem with these teen books is it feels to me sometimes like the main characters aren't given enough of a internal voice. I thought that this time I felt more who Barbara was. I guess
Yeah.
I felt Jean pretty strongly.
I'll agree with that. Yeah.
And I think that similarly to Jean and Johnny, this is a book that discusses romance only to kind of keep it at arm's length and kind of say, it's not really the end all of your life.
Yeah, and I did find it stuck with the pattern of like exploring the growth of a young woman, sort of as each book has kind of advanced on the thesis that Beverly Cleary has presented as like, what constitutes growing up, what constitutes getting older, what, you know, revelations do you learn, should you learn? I did feel like this book continued that exploration by like exploring an avenue of romance that we hadn't explored from a teenager's perspective, which is the what is expected of you after you're done with high school romance.
Right.
And should I go ahead and give a little rundown of the story?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, so Sister of the Bride is the story of 16... She's 16, right?
She's 16, yes.
Yeah, story of 16-year-old Barbara McLean and her experiences coming of age in the shadow of her older sister Rosemary's impending nuptials. Barbara feels perpetually left behind by Rosemary, forever stuck with her sister's hand-me-downs, and decides that since she'll probably inherit Rosemary's wedding as well, she'd better help make it a picture-perfect event. Unfortunately, Rosemary wants a low-key, modern affair that reflects the changing styles and attitudes of 1963. What follows is a multi-layered look at the newly recognized generation gap as both sisters struggle with the wants and desires of several generations of family. Barbara also struggles with the attention of two young men, tall and awkward Tootie Bodger and sporty and exciting Bill Cunningham. She also redefines her relationship with her brother Gordy and starts learning to see the world through the eyes of the people around her. Sister of the Bride ends with Rosemary happily married and Barbara discovering that her own future need not be tied to the decisions of her sister. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. But again, there's like a million other things going on.
There's a cliche in romance fiction that marriage is the end. That's the traditional tie it with a bow, you know, from drama. We all know this way back when. That's when the play is over, is when everyone gets married off.
Yeah.
And there's a tradition in romance novels and certainly in romance comics from this time of being focused on the event of marriage. There were like romance comics about young brides, for example. And so it's interesting to me that Barbara is in this position of looking at this what would have seen as sort of the apex of romance at the time. And Barbara has, in many ways, more old-fashioned views than her sister.
Yeah, yeah. It reminds me of, I guess it's the way that, like, the younger generation is always going to be, they're always going to be living a little bit more in a fantasy world, like the younger a kid is. And Rosemary has gotten just enough of a hint of what's to come that it's, I don't know, she's in a bit of a whirlwind as far as like what she wants. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting, like why it struck me as very realistic that Barbara is the one who's more traditional. But I think that comes more from what you said, like her view of marriage as being this like event that's supposed to look like a storybook and Rosemary pulling away from that.
Right. The other thing that is changing is the expectation of what a woman's life is going to be after marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was that sequence in a shower that's given for Rosemary where they discuss, the sisters discuss how important it is to go ahead and get your college degree because you want to have a career. And they say, they talk about how they just don't want their minds to go to waste as homemakers. And the older generation, who at this point are women who got married probably back in the 20s, are very taken aback by this and very upset by this idea that their minds went to waste as homemakers. They say, well, you know, I was too busy learning how to cook with wood, and you know, they're talking about houses without plumbing and raising 12 kids and whatever.
Well, I found that whole scene, so the group of people throwing the shower are known as the Amys,
right?
Which is like the name of their mother's like social group, and the Amys all throw this shower, and before the shower Rosemary and Barbara are talking about how like Rosemary's going to get all these goofy presents and she's got to put on like a smile and be polite. But we all know that this is going to be a dopey thing thrown by a bunch of grownups. But then when they're there, Rosemary, you watch her slowly succumb. It's almost like this like seduction of the Amys where their attitudes and lifestyles, you see Rosemary not be as jaded and put off by them. And it sort of startles Barbara that she's watching her sister slowly consider becoming something that... Because Barbara wants an old-fashioned wedding, but she also wants her sister to be independent thinking. And the Amys kind of represent this world of women as homemakers and the Leave It to Beaver stay-at-home mom, wear pearls when you're cooking and high heels when you're doing when you're vacuuming the carpet. Whereas Barbara and Rosemary represent this early 60s, like, coming out of, you know, this, like, sudden, like, for want of a better term, like, this sort of, like, women's lib thinking that Rosemary's very familiar with because she's in college, and that Barbara seems to be familiar with because she pays a lot of attention to Rosemary.
Yeah. Rosemary is also a student at UCal Berkeley.
Yeah.
In 63, right when that's actually starting to become a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's interesting to think this is not really the counterculture per se. This is beatniks at this
yes.
time. And Rosemary has all the attitudes and trappings of a beatnik. You know, she's interested in cubist art. There's a point where she talks about having a Paul Klee print that she's really fond of. She's, you know, she's going to college and she's interested in literature. The father of the family teases a lot about this, about how the kids are becoming radicalized, but it's obviously not the same kind of radicalization that you would associate with later in the 60s.
Oh no, of course not.
You know, the things that Rosemary wants different about her life is she wants to have less material possessions. She wants to have. She's attracted to modern things that are earth toned,
yes.
and simple and handmade is a big deal. She wants the place setting she has for her when she gets married. What's the husband's name?
Greg. Yeah.
Yes, she wants her and Greg to have these plates made by a potter they know. Even in 63, Cleary has her ear to the ground in a way that's quite impressive, that she's picking this out of the ether.
I agree, because it's a story that exists very specifically in 1963. Like, it's the beginning of the 60s. It's not the mid-60s. It's not the late 60s. It's not the late 50s. This divide between the generations really started coming to a head at this point. I mean, that's when we got the term generation gap. And the fact that not only does Beverly Cleary very nicely illustrate this impending revolution of the generations, she divides it between Rosemary and Barbara. Rosemary's only 2 years older than Barbara. But there's even a gap between them. Like, there will be a difference in Barbara's experience in college versus Rosemary's 2 years later at this point in history. Like, things are not that Beverly Cleary could have known this, but she seems aware that the gap between the sisters is going to be wider than the gap between them would have been 10 years before.
Yeah, there's all kinds of gaps in the story, too. There's again, an economic gap here, because the sisters' parents are both teachers.
Yeah.
They aren't making a lot of money, whereas Bill, the one of her suitors,
yeah.
his mom has a job of being a writer for big magazines,
mm-hmm.
and it's seen as quite thrilling and almost scandalous that this woman has a career that is so lucrative and so high profile. And that becomes an interesting thing that goes back and forth between Bill and Barbara. But also there's a point where Greg corrects Rosemary's language, her grammar,
yeah.
and makes a statement about it being, oh, this is how people speak in the West. And so there's a kind of a gap there between East Coast, West Coast, and everyone's class conscious. Everyone is, there's anxiety that runs through a lot of these relationships.
Yeah. And what did Greg's family do? I can't remember what their, because he had money as well.
Yeah, I forgot.
There's several examples in this story of that socioeconomic gap having awkward implications as far as people's relationships go. But yeah, his parents are, because the whole thing is that Rosemary's family is supposed to pay for the wedding, and Greg's family offers to pay for some of it, and it's this like super insult to the parents that they made this offer. They're like, "Oh, we can pay for that," and they're like, "Nope." And one of my favorite examples of the money issue is there's this whole subplot with Rosemary and Barbara's grandmother had a veil, a wedding veil, this beautiful handmade like lace wedding veil, and her dream was to pass it on to her daughters for their wedding, but then Rosemary and Barbara's mom got married on like a army base and didn't even have a real like fancy wedding, and then their aunt never got married. So the grandmother wants Rosemary to wear this veil, and it's very meaningful to her, and it's like very emotional when she gives it to her. And Rosemary's like, who was originally just going to wear like a suit to get married in, is like, "I'll wear the veil." And once she accepts that the veil as part of her like ensemble, then all of a sudden she has to wear a nice wedding dress. And because she has to wear a nice wedding dress, then all of a sudden the bridesmaids have to look nice. And then the venue has to look nicer. And then they have to get nicer flowers. And it ups the amount of money being spent. And that affects the way Barbara sees the wedding, because that expense was something she had never like thought about. And when the veil, for various reasons being destroyed by the cat, ends up not being able to be used in its original form, there's this great line that stood out, because they're always so worried about, because grandma's getting very old and she's getting very emotional recently as she's getting older, and they're worried that grandma will be upset when she sees that the veil has been tattered. And the mom says, "Your grandmother, even though she is old and her feelings are easily hurt, is a woman of character who has survived many disappointments in her lifetime. And although she will be upset when she hears what happened, I'm sure she'll be happy that enough of her veil was saved for Rosemary to wear." And I loved that the notion of a woman who, the strength of character brought about by surviving many disappointments, like, is something that's presented to these kids as the strength of character. I don't know. There was something about that whole subplot and the way it worked out as like not even being about the veil, but about being about these multiple generations of women learning to see their grandmother and the generations above them in a different light as survivors, as people who have come up through hardship and aren't going to be, they're not going to be ended by something as small as a wedding veil. They'll be disappointed, but their lives have been made up of disappointments. And I thought that was just a very like powerful statement for Beverly Cleary to make at that point in the book.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that Cleary takes everyone's opinions or everyone's feelings very seriously in this book. The grandmother is extremely invested as in this wedding, and it is going to be crushing to her that her veil is destroyed.
Yeah,
and I think that but again, Cleary is such a quiet author and lets these things kind of just pass. I was glancing down here to see if I could find out what Greg's parents did, but the thing that I'm still not finding that, but one thing that I find from my notes is Greg is a history English major. So he's kind of rebelling too.
Yeah.
And he also has been paying his way in school by being in the Air Force, I assume ROTC. Uh-huh. But I don't, I, which I don't know. So again, there's a, that's, that bespeaks a kind of a post-war, that as a pathway towards, building your life really came out of World War II. My dad was ROTC actually in the Air Force. One other thing I just want to mention here, because we have talked about how it being very specifically in 1963, Barbara's younger brother,
Gordy,
Gordy, who is 13, all through the book is trying to practice with for a folk group that he's in. And it's amazing that she's Cleary is quoting the Worried Man Blues at one point in here, and songs by Handy and stuff, and she's got all that down pat. I think that it's funny because I know these songs, but I also know exactly the time that she's talking about. This is the time when of like the Kingston Trio and stuff, when people there actually was a vogue for folk songs, not like what happened later in the 60s where you had people like Joni Mitchell coming along or Joan Collins coming along. This was the people who were actually singing like traditional folk songs, and it was super popular.
I was really tickled by that because, again, like you said, like 5 years earlier, 5 years later, he would have been trying to learn rock or rockabilly or something along those lines. It is that very pinpointed. And because, like you said, she gives these very, very specific examples of the songs he's singing, it really not only fills out the world, but it fills out his character because he's kind of a jerky kid. But there's something so earnest about him trying to become this folk musician. oh, by the way, Greg's father made a lot of money in the luggage business. But he's not terribly intellectual.
Yes. Yeah. That's the other thing is both families seem to talk smack about each other behind each other's back all the time. And there's a lot of emphasis placed upon whether people are intellectual enough. You know, there is a soreness here with the older generation looking at the younger generation going off to college. Yeah. I think the assumption is that these are the first kids off in college, because when Barbara says that Greg's parents aren't intellectual enough, her own dad says, "Well, I'm not intellectual enough either," and it becomes it becomes yet another sticking point.
Yeah, there's a I agree. There's a speaking of like parents, Barbara and Rosemary's father, Mr. McLean, his attitude seems a lot more parentally conservative than a lot of the parents Beverly Cleary's written. And he's got that typical Beverly Cleary father, like bad dad jokes and like that, like sort of like bitter sense of humor that runs through everything he says. But he's also, she makes a point, when his dinner ends, he's all cigar. And one of the women in the house better bring him a cigar. And one of the women in the house has got to bring him an ashtray. It's just, that's part of his routine. And there's something about that I hadn't noticed in other fathers, especially in the teen series. They were always presented as a little more goofy or loosey-goosey with the rules. I mean, they were usually those staunch 50s fathers, but there's something about Mr. McLean that strikes me as he's leaning really hard on traditional values. And I'm wondering if it's because he's seeing this change occurring in the culture.
Right. Well, he was a serviceman in World War II is the other thing. When Barbara's mother is talking with the sisters about things, she describes how her own wedding was not very happy, that they were basically on a base, and that was when they got married there. And so I wouldn't say he's as bad as Archie Bunker, but he represents that generation of no-nonsense guys who came through the war okay, came back and got set up. Now, it's interesting, he is a teacher. I agree. He is a lot more essentialist in his gender.
But again, thoughts. like you said, like Cleary is very sympathetic towards her characters, and he's never presented as unreasonable or a villain in the piece. He's not trying to get in his daughter's way. He's just got a different idea of what is sensible than they do. I mean, the parents seem put off by a lot of what Rosemary wants, but they're going along with it.
When we talk about the sort of sensitivity that Clary brings to this, one of the chapters I loved the most in this book was when Rosemary has announced that she and Greg are going to be landlords.
Yeah.
They've found an arrangement that they are going to be the superintendents for an apartment building, and they're going to collect rent, and they're going to be there to make sure the building's okay. And she takes Barbara over to see the place. And it's such an interesting, first of all, again, this fascinating look at what it meant to be that kind of young, broke, beatnik kid in Berkeley in 63. And it's got a certain level of grimy realism to it that I have never seen in any other Clary book. She's discussing in no uncertain terms how beat up this place is, how shabby this place is, how combative and irritating the tenants are. And yet Barbara is, on the one hand, ecstatic that she has her own place, but she also recognizes that it's not that great a place.
Oh, definitely. The earthiness of that scene, Beverly.
I'm sorry, not Barbara's.
Rosemary, yeah.
Right. Rosemary is ecstatic. Barbara is horrified.
Yeah. Well, and horrified not only because the place is a dump, but because it shatters her idea of what post-wedding is supposed to be. Like, you're supposed to go away with your husband to a cute little place. It's supposed to be idyllic after you get married. And instead, she's already being made to clean out garbage bins by the tenants who are already complaining to her as their landlord. And she's going to have to start dealing with the screaming kid upstairs.
This is where we have the mention where Rosemary pulls out her print of the Paul Klee painting, Portrait of Mo, which was in the Phillips collection. And anyone who wants to can just Google that right now. It's one of Klee's major works. The other thing that's fascinating is she points to a painting on the wall of The End of the Trail, which is actually not originally a painting. This is a statue by James Frazier. That's a 19th century statue that was one of the many strange statues that got put up around the country, sort of celebrating Native Americans, but not really. And it was notable at the time because Frazier tried to depict a horse stopping at the edge of a precipice. That's what people liked in art back then, was like, ooh, it looks just like that horse is going to topple off the edge of a cliff. Its back legs were off the ground, and he achieved this by having the tail be the support for the statue. So it's funny that it's a picture of a famous sculpture, and
it represents people about to fall over a cliff, and
right, exactly. And Rosemary finds it ridiculous kitsch, because she thinks that as being, oh my god, look at this old, you know, it's sort of like if you came across a Remington in someone's house today. It's sort of like, yeah, on the one hand, an important work of art. On the other hand, yeah.
Well, and I love the fact that she was given the painting by her friends. Like, it was a going away. It was like a wedding gift for their new place. And it doesn't just say a novel's worth about her and her relationship. It says a lot about the crowd she was running with in college. And I guess still is, because she's still in college. But yeah, it's very... And as soon as I read it, I looked it up. Like, I was like, I don't know what this painting is. And to see it is like, oh, okay, I know exactly what they're talking about. Like, it's perfect. It's not... And it's not making fun of of this new art style, this new popular with the kids art style. It's not drawing any kind of judgment about this. It's simply using it as for illustrative purposes.
Yeah, I mean, how many other things get mentioned in this book? They mention E.E. Cummings at one point. They mention...
Wasn't that in the argument scene with the...
Right. They're arguing about grammar.
That's an interesting... Because that's an interesting moment. Right before the wedding, Greg and Rosemary get into a fight about her word usage versus his word usage. And he's kind of a jerk. Kind of really a jerk about it, but it's sort of played off as this is pre-wedding jitters. They're both nervous. It seems like they're going to call the wedding off, but it's just them being very nervous about each other right at this moment. And
Rosemary says the cat wants out, and Greg complains about this, which I feel like that's a call off the wedding.
He's really rude about it. But what's funny is years and years later, she's going to write a very, very similar scene to this in Ramona Forever. And so we'll get to touch on decades later, Beverly Cleary's handling of almost the same moment through the eyes of another child. I just think it's something, it seems that Beverly Cleary feels that the day of a wedding is the time when the bride and the groom are going to suddenly be at each other's throats about stupid things. And I'm wondering if it's something she may have witnessed in her actual life. I was going to say, one thing that I really liked about this book also was the attention it drew to wedding preparation in the early 60s. And to, there's a bunch of just great call-outs as to, like, fashion and styles. And it painting this neat picture of what it's like to, like, go out shopping for these kind of clothes in like 1963.
What I was looking up all the time, this were all the different
fabrics.
Yes,
that was doing that too. If you're using a Kindle, you can just highlight the word and it'll give you the definition. And there was one that she didn't want because it was going to fade. She's convinced that whatever wedding dress her sister has is going to be hers as well, because the family won't be able to afford two. And she expects to get married at the same time, like in 2 years, basically. And there's one of the fabrics is known to fade to like a shade of yellow or something that she's convinced she'll end up having to wear down the aisle. And I found that a very like sweet, very touching little moment where she wants her sister to look good because she wants herself to look good in a couple of years.
Yeah. I was going to suggest we might as well turn to the two bows of Barbara.
Can we finally
here.
Talk about Tootie Bodger?
Yes. Tootie Bodger. Tootie Bodger is actually the first character introduced in the book.
Yeah.
In the sequence at the very beginning, Tootie Bodger is walking Barbara home.
And I'm going to say this right off the bat. Because we're seeing this whole thing through Barbara's point of view, you only get to see Tootie Bodger from her perspective, and she only has bad things to say about him. So you're not building up any kind of sympathy towards this guy. The nicest thing she can say about Tootie Bodger is that he plays the trombone. Is that what he? But she says
I played the trombone.
The whole school respected him for his ability to play the tiger rag. And I made one note on that. I just said, did they? That was my first note I took on this book. I was like, the whole school, huh? That's great. And that's the only nice thing she has to say about him. She brings it up again. She's like, he can play the tiger rag really well. Yeah, I'm trying to find, she says in the very first paragraph that, you know, their lives, they're parallel lines that just aren't going to meet. And he's tall, he's 6'4". It's just the first thing she says about him was Tootie, who was 6'4" and played the trombone, had his problems. And then it just goes on about him just complaining about his problems.
And his problems consist of everyone wants him to try out for basketball and he doesn't want to. When I was in high school, I tried out for basketball and I failed utterly because I had not actually been playing basketball up to that point. So you can't just run into at age whatever 14, 15 and just assume the team is going to be happy to teach you right. how to play with kids who've been playing for the last 6-7 years.
But it is that weird thing where, like, from his perspective, like, every authority figure at the school is, like, pressuring him into playing basketball. And not even her parents or not even Gordy can understand why he's not trying out for basketball. He's like, why a fellow with his bill doesn't go out for basketball beats me? And she says, Tootie doesn't like basketball. He can't see any point in throwing a ball through a hoop. Which, I mean, I guess Tootie, he's just sullen and quiet and he obviously likes Barbara, but he keeps like hinting about them doing something together and she keeps changing the subject. It's incredibly awkward.
He wants to go on a date and she keeps tiptoeing around him. And one of the things that this book makes painfully clear to a male reader is all that nonsense that women have to go through about trying to protect the man's feelings. Barbara does an awful lot of that in this book of, you know, later in the book, we'll talk about Bill when he does something stupid. She calls him out on it. And then she feels like, oh, should I really have done that? And you're like, yeah.
Unfortunately, sure she does come to the conclusion that, yes, she should have done that. And she sticks to her guns pretty well. So she's always trying to like avoid just not like putting poor Tootie off, which, of course, just makes him think that she's interested in him. Like, because he's clueless, and as long as she's not, like, being rude and saying no, he's just going to keep following her around everywhere she goes. She's, like, changing her habits at school to avoid him, because she knows that he'll, like, follow her wherever she is. And then Bill comes along on his Vespa.
Yes. Another scene that can only take place in this time. He stopped behind a sound truck. Is that what they call it? Which is one of those old things you see in newsreels whenever someone would go through town declaring they're running for office. And they have the little speakers that go around it. And this one is playing Chattanooga Choo Choo. And Bill charms Barbara by saying, oh, they're playing our song, and offering her a ride home. Now, that's kind of telling, too, there, because Chattanooga Choo Choo, of course, is a song from, is it the 30s or 40s? I mean, it was popular in World War II.
Yeah, it's an old standard.
It's an old song by now. It's an old standard, but to Barbara, who doesn't like things new, and it's kind of charming to her.
The truck is blaring Chattanooga Choo Choo, and it has a sign that says, don't horse around, call Joe's TV repair today. So I guess, like, back then that was legal. Like, you could just blast music out of your truck to get people's attention. And then there's Bill. He is quite a... I like the way she writes Bill's character, because he's... I mean, she's kind of done this before with guys, but he's kind of a charmer. You're like, oh, and he likes Barbara. He obviously is... He's energetic and he's upbeat. And they don't... You don't notice it at first until Barbara starts calling it out, but you realize that he's only hanging out with her to get free food. Like, he comes to her house and they sit on the stoop and she starts making cookies for him. And then he just keeps coming back to get more cookies.
He's the one whose mom has this high-powered career. And early on, he complains to her about how he wishes he could come home to a home-cooked meal. So again, it's this these changing roles for women. Bill's not particularly happy about it because he would like his mom to be more feminine. Now, whatever you think of that, it's pretty ooky that he's on to Barbara because he kind of is making this maternal transfer to her, like he wants her to.
Yeah, it says, and it says there's a quote that I actually highlighted where he's talking to Barbara early on, and he says, "Anyway, Mom bought me the Vespa." And it says, Barbara was a little shocked by this statement. In her family, a gift came from both parents, no matter which one earned the money that paid for it. And I think that's another, like, one of those little tells about the difference between her family structure and Bill's family structure. And it's just very clear that Bill has a rich mom and not rich parents. Yeah, she writes advertising copy for women's clothing stores and is the most fashionably dressed commuter at the bus station. Yeah, there's so much in this. Because this book takes place, like, we've seen books that take place in the suburbs, we've seen books that take place in, like, in the city, but this book takes place, kind of bounces around locales a lot between different socioeconomic groups, between just their house to the apartment. Like, you see, like, it's just, I don't know, there's something, this book just seems to cover a lot of ground in a way that the previous books didn't.
Yeah, it does. It's a substantial book. You know, I have a copy here that my copy, I actually have it on Kindle too, but I have an old copy. I don't exactly know where I got it from because I certainly did not read this in my childhood. I think I got this when my oldest child was reading Beverly Cleary. It's a Scholastic book from 63. And it's a little interesting because it also shows that this is a third printing. So this book actually, these books must have been fairly successful in their time.
The copy I have is, I have a paper copy, and it was I guess this is from the 90s, but I mean, this is from 96. They're still reprinting these.
Yeah, this has 254 pages in it, and it's not small. It's not large type. It's... it's about the size and density of a...
Yeah, it's a young adult novel.
It's a novel.
Does yours have illustrations?
Mine does not have illustrations. That's sad because I've seen the original editions online and they have the Cush illustrations.
Oh, really? Yeah, that would be nice. Yeah, because, again, this is part of the repackaging where they're trying to sell these as more... modern romances to girls.
I don't know how you would. How do you pass this off as a modern romance?
You just make the cover as vague as you could possibly can. You just make it a bunch of. This cover is just yellow with a bunch of flowers all over it and red ribbons. Like, that's it. There's no indication this is a period story. Even the back is just like. It just talks about how, like, you know, the basic plot, but not when it takes place. And as with any of these teen books, every single decade they're printed reflects the decade that they were printed in. Like, there's one that's clearly from, like, the 80s, and the outfits of the photographic, like, realistic drawing on the front is very clearly 1980s fashions. And the most recent version of it just has a bouquet of flowers. And there's a copy that has, like, arms reaching up to grab a bridal bouquet. That's the one with the illustrations. There's one that looks like a hymnal almost with, like, in the church. And you see, like, Rosemary wearing green and... Barbara wearing green and Rosemary in the background with her veil.
Right, that's the one I have.
That's the one you have? Yeah. And there's one with, like, this, like... Do you remember when Mad Men was popular? And that was that whole, like... Design your own avatar
right.
in Mad Men style. There's one that looks exactly like that. Like, it's in that style of these two women. They look to be in their 30s. It's that thing where, like, publishers just do not know how to sell these books.
It's interesting you mentioned Mad Men because that was a popular series. And this is basically exactly that period.
Yeah,
about about season two or three of Mad Men, and it, except without all the angst, and
yes.
You know, I think that there is a market for people wanting to read actual historical novels. I just don't get it.
Does this would that kind of marketing work though? Like when people think Mad Men, they think when that era when they think like. Early 60s, they're thinking like cool, like, oh, this is when everyone was like, well, like Mad Men. and it's mostly just like, no, most people were just kind of kids or adults like working their jobs. It's a tough sell. Like, I think it's a tough sell, like just getting kids to read books about weddings. Like, I'll be totally honest, when we first started doing this, I wasn't looking forward to doing the teen girl novels. Like, I thought they'd be agonizingly boring, and instead they've become like the four of my favorite young adult books I've ever read.
One thing that's interesting when you say this about not wanting to read, kids not wanting to read books about marriage, the other thing that really struck me as interesting in this is one of the early conflicts in the book is that the McLean parents don't want Rosemary to get married so young.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of talk about how, why are they doing this while they're still in school? It's like, why don't they do it after Greg has a career and settles down? And this marks a different attitude towards marriage that's coming into the forefront. It also is that interesting, at the end of the book, part of what happens is Barbara decides between the two suitors that she doesn't really have to decide between her suitors. She's not really serious about either one of them. Why not just go ahead and enjoy whatever activities she does with either of them and see what comes next in her life? There's an emphasis being placed here upon letting yourself be a child while you're a child.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's fascinating that that's something that Cleary has to address, because I think there was a move towards younger and younger marriages around this time. And that was the case, I would say, up until the 70s, probably.
No.
And somewhere in the 80s, people started deferring their marriages. And I think that the deferred marriages, interestingly enough, are one result of women's liberation in the 70s.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting, because in this book, these young women trying to find their place in life and what their life is apart from their role as presumptive wives, you know, that this is kind of a precursor to that.
I also find it interesting that it reflects, and I think one of the reasons I think it sits so well in the era in which it is because no one in the book seems to be sure what their feelings on it are. Like, everyone seems to want what the traditional situation, but they also want the younger people to have better than what they had. And like, there's this whole thing of like, she shouldn't get married so young because she needs to finish college. But also there's this presumption on the Amy's part that you should have your college education, but you're not going to use it for anything, because then you're going to get married and you're going to have kids, and then you're just going to be a housewife. But also college is important, but also being this traditional mother is important. And even the kids are being pulled in both directions. I think all the generations in this book are feeling this change, this shift, and a lot of the conflict is internal, like on all their parts, because of this massive generational like upheaval that's coming up.
Ambiguity and even ambivalence are the order of the day for almost everyone in this book.
Yeah,
and that's really, really surprising to me. And I think that speaks the way that Cleary sets up expectations and dashes them. I think that, as you said, when we were discussing Tootie and how, because one of the things that's frustrating about Tootie is, as milquetoast and as much of a limp noodle as he is, he is also, you also get the creeping suspicion that he's going to turn out to be the nice kid.
Yeah.
And that somehow the story is going to be about Barbara learning, oh, I should have recognized that this guy is sweet on the inside, so I'll put up with the fact that he's as boring as
a Tootie Bodger.
As Tootie Bodger. And that somehow Bill is going to end up disappointing. And in the end, it's like, neither one's great shakes, yeah, but who cares? But you're given that expectation that this is going to be a book about her having to make a choice or having to learn something about the character of these two boys so that she understands more about what she wants out of a relationship. And in the end, it's sort of like, huh, what, who knows? And Rosemary, you think, is either going to... There's either going to be an epiphany where she realizes that marriage is the greatest thing in the world, or and that will be enough to ameliorate all of her situation. But I think that as the book closes, they treat the wedding with a lot of reverence, but the expectation is Rosemary and Greg now have a difficult life ahead of them.
Yeah, and I think that they're aware of that, and the ambiguity and the discombobulation and the way that all of their equilibriums are thrown off, like, constantly throughout the story, and the way it just ends with everyone's equilibrium still kind of being a little bit off, is far more satisfying than if we had had any kind of pat ending. Because part of the thesis of this book is that there's no endings. Like, there's no fairy tale. There's no point where you say the end. You just keep going, and things are hard, and they're weird, and they're ambiguous, and nothing is 100% good, and nothing is not everything. Like, there's not just a series of good or bad choices. It's usually shades of gray, and everything is going to be a little bit disappointing. She never turns around and says, like, but you got to find the good in everything or anything like that. It's just like, nope. Life is disappointing sometimes. You may as well be a kid while you're a kid, and you don't have to come to any decisions yet. The end.
If what we've described here sounds like some sort of Raymond Carver-esque slice of life depression script, it's not. It's a very light and fun,
yeah,
and joyful book. And it has moments in it that are those kind of cleary moments of, like, oh, here's something funny. I mean, the cat destroying the veil, is funny. It seems like everyone in 1963 was really big about playing strange practical jokes. There was yeah, the Amy's put alarm clocks in with all the presents that Rosemary was opening, and then later when Rosemary's moving into the apartment, her friends sent her with a box full of canned goods that had the
terrible
labels removed from them, so they couldn't tell what they were.
That caused me so much anxiety when I was reading about it. No, it's a very enjoyable book. I think it rounds out the quartet very nicely. I would say that if you haven't read any of these books, I would definitely recommend reading them in the order in which they were published, because they do form a rough progression of development, how a child matures into young adulthood. Like, it follows steps along the way, and I think that they form a very satisfying miniseries in and of themselves.
They're also interesting in the way that the first book takes place still in Oregon, but the other books are Cleary's continued love letter to California.
Yeah.
And this is a particularly interesting look at a time in San Francisco that is really an interesting time in San Francisco history, and certainly formative to what would come after. So it's really fun to read something which is clearly outside of her normal milieu.
Yeah, there's a big part of me that wishes she had continued to write, not necessarily novels about teenagers, but continued writing novels about young women as the years went on. Like, so we could get more of an idea, more of a reflection of the changing world from a young person's perspective, because I'd be interested in seeing, like, what kind of novel she would write about a person in their 20s in the late 60s. I assume that she would have some interesting perspective on all of that.
I wonder if there's something in Cleary's personality that just stopped there.
Yeah.
Because obviously in the 1970s, Judy Blume famously went on to write adult novels along with her children's books. And Cleary was in the height of her powers in the 70s there. She could have very easily written her version of Wifey or whatever that was. But on the other hand, I just feel like there's something in her that's not what she's interested
in. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, I'm sure, very, very true. Like you said, like she was now at a point, and we are with this book, with Sister of the Bride, we are now hitting a major turning point in her books. Starting with our next book, things are going to start getting odd and a little more experimental, with like author's voice, with who she chooses to be her protagonists. And then soon enough, we're jumping right into the Ramona series, which will carry her through into the 80s.
Well, Ramona and, of course, Ralph S. Mouse.
Yes. But Ralph S. Mouse, like, those books are like 1965, 1970, and then like 1982. Like, yep. She spaced those out a lot, but she was writing the Ramona books just one after another for a while. I think four Ramona books published in a row. And that's the first time she ever did that with a series.
And of course, those are the books that are probably the pinnacle of her career. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, so am I. Yep. So, all right. Well, I guess we'll pick up next time with Ribsy, if you're reading along at home.
Okay. Well, bye.
Goodbye.
Thanks to Gina Radcliffe of the Kill by Kill podcast for reading this episode's excerpt. Click It Cast is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts at theincomparable.com.